From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Two prominent progressive Mormon activists have been called before their local leaders and threatened with excommunication unless they back away from their respective crusades and public comments criticizing church doctrine or leadership. As one letter put it, they're being asked to turn away from the current path they've taken. Today in the program, we're talking with these two. Kate Kelly, the founder of the group Ordain Women. It's an effort to get women the Mormon priesthood. And John DeLynn will also join us. He's the founder of a podcast that raises critical questions about church history and policy. Both are working from within the church right now, but what happens if they're not? If excommunication makes them outsiders to the faith, what then? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. About a week ago, John DeLynn received a letter from his stake president. He was probably expecting the letter. On his popular podcast, Mormon Stories, DeLynn had been public and outspoken about his criticism of church policies and his skepticism about church history. In the letter, the leader asked if he wanted to just quit the church, have his name removed from the records, or if he wanted to fight it out, that is, respond to a church disciplinary council. At about that time, Kate Kelly got a similar letter from her own stake president. Kelly is the founder of the group Ordain Women. It's an organization and a website that lobbies church leaders to allow women to be ordained with the Mormon priesthood. Her letter told her to turn away from the path she was on. Another letter she received from her bishop mentioned that she faced the possibility of excommunication. It's been a while, but these kinds of things happen from time to time in the LDS Church. In the 1980s, Mormon feminists were warned. In 1993, six outspoken writers and scholars were excommunicated, purged, some are calling it. John DeLynn says excommunication, or the threat anyway, is a way to release pressure. If you're a believer with a family in the church and most of your neighbors in the church, excommunication can be frightening and isolating. It's too early to say what will happen with DeLynn and Kelly, of course. Some wonder if all of this is just a scare tactic, just some way to get them to keep quiet, which is a little like a brushback pitch that you throw when a batter is crowding the plate. DeLynn and Kelly are getting maybe a little too close for the comfort of LDS church leaders. Well, today in the program, we're talking about this story. John DeLynn and Kate Kelly will be joining us in a moment. Joining us first on the program for some perspective is Joanna Brooks, who blogs at Feminist Mormon Housewives. She's also the author of the memoir, The Book of Mormon Girl, Stories from an American Faith. She's an associate dean of research and graduate affairs at San Diego State University, and she's joining us by phone from her office in San Diego. And Joanna Brooks, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Doug, thank you for having me.
So I guess the first question is, were you at all surprised by the news of these letters?
I was, and I want to note that many people were surprised. The impacts of this news have radiated not only, you know, immediately to John and Kate and their families, but across many, many LDS people who have followed the Ordained Women movements or who have listened to John's podcast, and even those who share silently in some of the concerns John and Kate have raised.
I wonder, one of the things you've written is, the question you've talked about is what it is that these kinds of courts, these disciplinary councils, this threat of excommunication, what that tells us about what you've called the unwritten rules of Mormon life, this matter of when it's okay to ask questions and when it's okay to disagree and in what form you can do all of this, and then when you've crossed the line. What do we know now by these initial attempts to get Kate Kelly and John DeLynn into these disciplinary councils about what the boundary might be in the 21st century?
Exactly, Doug. I think you've hit on the crucial point there. We know there is a long history in the LDS Church of using excommunication not only for sort of routine disciplinary matters in cases of serious transgression, but in also where cases where of doctrinal disagreement or just in cases where individuals have brushed leadership the wrong way. I mean, this is a history that dates back to the 19th century. In the late 20th century, we saw excommunication levied most notably at feminist activists like Sonia Johnson, who was excommunicated in late 1979, basically on the grounds of two speeches she had made that were misconstrued to accuse church leaders of misogyny. In the early 90s, the September 6th, Margaret Toscano, Lavinia Fielding Anderson, Maxine Hanks, there were doctrinal disagreements, sometimes at the heart of these matters, or in the case of Lavinia Fielding Anderson, raising questions about the church's surveillance of its membership through the Strengthening the Members Committee. But this is the first time we've seen individuals brought up on excommunication publicly in the internet era. And the questions are more complicated now. We've seen tremendous growth in online forums where complicated and controversial aspects of the faith are being discussed. This is what the internet does. Mm-hmm. What are the rules now about how Mormons are to conduct themselves in this time? Is it inappropriate to imagine that excommunicating John and Kate will change, you know, the kind of discussion that's taking place on the internet among Mormons today?
You know, one of the things that came out in the letter to Kate Kelly was her stake president wrote that it's important that you understand you are not required to change your thinking or the questions you may have in your own mind, but you need to make it a private matter and work through this issue with your bishop or your branch president, which is saying in essence, Joanna Brooks, that it's okay to do this, but don't do it in public.
This is one of the unwritten rules that those of us who tend to be more questioning in our faith have tried to abide or have picked up on. We saw, for example, during the Proposition 8 controversy, those who spoke out in opposition as Mormons to the church's support for an involvement in anti-same-sex marriage politics in California were actually silenced, and church leaders use that word, silenced, by local ecclesiastical leaders who instructed them, often on penalty of losing their temple recommends, their access to participate in some of the most sacred rites in the faith, not to write letters to the editor in newspapers, not to publish opinion pieces online that differed from the official stance of the church. And there has been a quiet testing of those boundaries, or actually very visible and vocal testing of those boundaries in every blog and internet-based movements in Mormonism. You know, what is okay? And more importantly, does Mormonism as a faith have the vigor, have the confidence to withstand these inevitable explorations of complexities in its doctrine, policy, and practice?
Do you have a sense of the answer to that?
I say yes all the time because I believe that Mormonism is robust enough and vigorous enough that those of us who believe in the power, I get emotional, but those of us who believe in the power of the Restoration believe that there is nothing to fear. There is nothing to fear from honest exploration, even from people like Kate Kelly who organize, led by conscience, to press on issues where there is incompleteness and contradiction in our own doctrine, that this is the essence of religion and the essence of Mormonism especially is the seeking spirit. So, yes, we are watching these cases with great concern, but also with fierce hope that the outcomes will be different this time than in 1993 or in 1979, that we as a people and that our leaders who are tasked with this heavy, heavy burden of administering discipline, of strengthening the members, will find a way other than excommunication, which wounds not only the individual but the community, to resolve doctrinal disagreement, even in the most uncomfortable and aggressive circumstances, because both John and Kate have been very vocal, very public. So there's got to be a different way to handle this. We can.
Do you sympathize at all with church leadership, a group of gentlemen who are of a certain age? They're came of age, many of them, in a different time, certainly. And couldn't it be said that the success of Mormonism has come through its connection to orthodoxy and correlation and centralized power and, to be honest, probably intolerance of dissent, and that they're worried that this is going to change the essence of Mormonism, change
right.
how we define Mormonism.
Oh, no, it is a fearful time. I mean, and so much of this dates back to long accumulated historical fears. Mormonism responded to the extreme duress it was placed under, the extreme public persecution, political persecution in the 19th century by adopting, as you said, Doug, a very tightly managed corporate model of managing the church and its affairs during the 20th century. And we have seen the internet change the way governments have to do business, the way, you know, industries have to do business. And it's going to change the way religion deals with dissenting voices, heterodox voices. And it's a difficult moment the church finds itself in, trying to adjust to the new ground rules of the internet era.
I wonder, Joanna, and this is probably just speculation, but do you wonder, I mean, the question is, where did this come from? What the church seems to be saying, the LDS church seems to be saying, is that, look, these are local matters. But people are wondering, was it really that much of a coincidence that Kate Kelly and John DeLynn received their letters, basically within about a week of each other? So who's controlling this? Do you have a sense of that? Can you get any sense of what the factions are, the dynamic factions within Mormonism that might be, you know, the give and take of all of that? And do you think that's going on?
Doug, you've asked the million-dollar question that's kept the internet aflaming for days now.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, look, there is much speculation, much hearsay. You know, what we face, whether or not it is a coincidence of timing, is the fact that even if this is a local decision, local leaders feel empowered, if not obliged, to use excommunication as a tool when there is doctrinal disagreement that becomes vocal in public. And the utility of excommunication and its damage to individuals, families, friends, communities, the body of the church, and the reputation of Mormonism is what's at issue right now. Whether or not this was orchestrated, coordinated, it's happening. And it's happening in such a way that asks all of us to reflect on how we are to get along within this vibrant, robust, and increasingly diverse faith in the 21st century.
It's Joanna Brooks. She blogs at Feminist Mormon Housewives, also is the author of the Book of Mormon Girl, Stories from an American Faith. Joined us from her office in San Diego. Professor, thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a story causing a lot of reverberations here in Utah, home to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Two prominent people in the progressive Mormon community have been called before their local leaders, threatened with excommunication. They're both joining us today to talk about what all of this means for them personally, but also for the so-called Mormon moment. John DeLynn is joining us now on the program. He's creator and host of Mormon Stories. It's a podcast that focuses on Mormon faith and culture. He's a PhD candidate as well in psychology at Utah State University, and he's joining us from Utah Public Radio in Logan. And John DeLynn, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
So you got this letter. You were expecting it?
No, not at all. I felt really blindsided by it. I guess in the concreteness of it all, in the back of my mind, you know, when I started Mormon Stories 9 years ago, I always thought that this would be a possibility. And of course, when I spoke with my bishop in either January or early February of this year, you know, he told me that he was going to be starting up what for me would have been at least a third investigation over the past 10 years. And I didn't know what that meant. I told him, after talking to my wife, that we didn't want to participate in any more investigations because it was just too exhausting on our family. So I guess in the back of my mind, I knew that this was a possibility. But what I expected would happen would be that my stake president would reach out to me at some point if he was concerned. And we would have a series of conversations like I had with my prior state president before any possible disciplinary council would be held. And so, no, I did not expect to receive a letter that basically said, resign or a disciplinary council will be held, which is kind of what the letter basically said.
Well, what it said was this. Your state president said, I need to know exactly where you stand regarding your membership in the church. Why doesn't that seem reasonable?
No, it's totally reasonable. I don't think it's unreasonable at all.
What he seems to be saying is, so I know you felt blindsided, but what he's trying to say is, look, do you just want to quit? Do you just want to have your name removed from the records, or do you want to keep going with this? Because I think we've reached an impasse, John, and now we need to go somewhere else. Because you keep saying these things that are confusing to us as ecclesiastical leaders. Among them, and this was in that letter, he said, you said that you no longer believe many of the fundamental LDS church truth claims.
Right.
So what are they supposed to do with that? Because I think they're as confused as some who are outside of the church who were probably asking, why does he want to be in this thing if he doesn't believe these basic things? People inside and out are asking that question.
Yeah, well, those are all really good questions. I think I'm not alone in the church of having serious doubts about, many parts of the church's teachings. For example, the teachings about polygamy in D&C 132. I have a hard time believing that polygamy is of God. And so that's a section of the Doctrine and Covenants that I just can't believe.
Yeah.
I have a hard time believing the central narrative of the Book of Mormon, which is that God curses wicked people with dark skin. And I guess if I had a principle that I'm trying to stand on, it's that, thousands and tens of thousands and maybe even all Mormons have serious doubts at some level about various aspects of church doctrine or history or culture or practice. And I just want to say, I think that secrecy is one of the biggest problems in the church. And I think that our biggest problem in the church is that we can't speak openly about our doubts and concerns and even our disbelief.
I wonder if that's the question. So within Mormonism, what is the place of doubt? I mean, if you have doubts, if you don't believe, is there no place for you in Mormonism? I mean, you want to believe or you're trying to figure it out, but you don't buy, for example, the Golden Plate story. You don't believe Joseph Smith translated these plates. You don't believe these particular plates even really existed. But something about it you like. I mean, so where do you fit?
Well, other religious traditions, Judaism, Catholicism, there's a place for disbelief, for questioning or doubt. I think that's just a healthy part of religious engagement. I think our church is a younger church and we haven't carved out a space yet for progressives, for disbelievers. And so we have a harder time knowing how to deal with them. So this is a maturity process.
Yeah.
I think in 50 to 100 years, this won't be a problem. But I'll just also say, if we want to talk about what's confusing, think about the messages, the private message that Elder Holland gave to me, which is that we want you in this church. The public message that President Uchtdorf and others have sent saying, we want you even if you have doubts and disbelief. And so this is causing many to say, well, which is it? Is it President Uchtdorf, we want you even if you have doubts or disbelief? Or is it something else?
So what's your response to that? I mean, the church said in effect, and if I get this right, that this was something of a coincidence, that you were both called, you and Kate Kelly were both called in for disciplinary councils by local leaders. It wasn't directed by the central leadership of the church. A lot of people have a hard time believing that. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, we have to acknowledge the history that when the September 6th stuff happened, the Elder Oaks and others denied that this was coming from the top.
Yeah.
And then later, Elder Oaks had to apologize, as I understand it, saying that he misled people, that in reality, President Packer was involved in the September 6th. We also know that the church has a Strengthening the Members Committee where it keeps files on people and gives that information to local leaders. That's a matter of fact that Elder Holland acknowledged even recently. So, what's the purpose of that committee if it's not to influence what happens down below? But I also think that it can be very true. I think it's, I have friends who have spoken with my stake president. I hope to speak with him later this month. But the friends that have spoken to him say that he sincerely says that no one has told him to come after me. And that may be true. But I also have been told that area authorities and general authorities have been going around to stake presidents and saying to them, if you have dissidents, if you have apostates or people who are causing problems in your local congregations, you need to not be afraid to hold disciplinary courts. Mm. And so my understanding, it can be both. It can be that no explicit mandate was given from the top and that it came up from local levels, but also that influence from the top definitely has motivated local leaders to feel like they need to start coming out. And if those missives started coming out from area and regional and general authorities in a certain time frame, it's very reasonable that the process for Kate and the process for me were kicked off around the same time, and that naturally they've evolved to where they are at a similar time. But if there was more transparency in the process, we'd know. But we don't have transparency, and that's part of the problem.
Do you have a sense that there is a power vacuum within Mormonism right now? That and when you've got a power vacuum in an institution, someone who can be, you know, in charge to direct or manipulate leadership, if the leadership isn't entirely in alignment and there's some sort of power vacuum going on, that somebody can take advantage of that.
Yeah, I'm cousins with Ezra Taft Benson, and in, you know, September 1993, when the, you know, the September 6th happened, there was a power vacuum. It's well known that he was not able to lead the church. He died, you know, the year after, and you know, I've had many people, you know, I think it's fair for us to ask, is President Monson doing okay? I've heard many people report some form of dementia or Alzheimer's, and you know, the church is so powerful today that if it makes a misstep, it can wreak havoc not only in the lives of individual families, but for the church as a whole. So I think as the church has become a multi-billion dollar global corporation, you know, can it afford to continue having 80 or even 90-year-old men be in charge of the church when, if their health goes awry, it can create a power vacuum? And again, I'm speculating, but I think given the pattern here, I think it's a fair question to ask.
Spencer Kimball had been incapacitated by illness in the era of Sonia Johnson that Joanna Brooks referenced earlier, the era of Mormon feminism. In the so-called purge of 1993, you mentioned Ezra Taft Benson was incapacitated by illness. Today, as you said, there is some concern, or certainly rumors making their way through the Mormon and ex-Mormon blogosphere about Thomas S. Monson's health, whether he may have some form of dementia or even Alzheimer's, that he's been slowed by all of that, and that there's a power vacuum here, and the same kind of thing may be happening with Kate Kelly and you and others. Again, this effort to sort of corral dissidents. Do you think that's going on?
Yeah, very possibly. I've also heard that Proposition 8 was not a coordinated effort, that it was a single apostle or two that sort of felt really strongly about this, and that led to Proposition 8, and that there was not unanimity in the quorum. And so, yes, I think our church history has a record of certain apostles feeling strongly and striking out on their own and doing things that end up damaging the church, and then the full quorum in the First Presidency has to deal with it later. I don't know if that's happening here, but I think it's a fair question to ask, yeah.
How's your family taking all of this?
You know, it's been really hard. There have been a lot of tears shed over the past week, and I feel really guilty because in many ways I've brought it on my family. They've been super kind. It was really bizarre yesterday. I attended church with my family. One of my daughters was set apart to be the Beehive president. And so it's really bizarre to still have your family be in the church in some ways, but to be kind of out and to be there in front of the ward members. So it's an emotional time, but my family's been very supportive. I love them very much. And even better, just the thousands of people, community, local, national, global, who have reached out. It's been really heartwarming. But it's hard. This is really hard. It's a shaming process and in some ways a smearing process, this whole thing about disciplinary courts and excommunication. I've heard some people say it's a 15th century approach to a 21st century problem. And I think the process of excommunication is kind of barbaric. And I just think it's awful, and I hope no one has to go through it.
Let me read a few emails. This comes from Mike, who writes, "The recent news about John and Kelly, Kate, has really rocked me to the core." Mike writes, "I've been trying to live as a New Order Mormon for the past 6 months, and now that these two advocates that people in my shoes look up to are being subjugated and coerced into submission and conformity, and I wonder if there actually is a place for people like me in the church. I'm not personally outspoken, although I would like to be. I'm too afraid to be met with retribution, so instead I simply try not to actively participate in the groupthink that goes on every Sunday, but I want to speak up. Now, seeing these people who do speak up get reprimanded, I do not think I can continue to participate." How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think one of my biggest concerns is that by punishing Kate and myself, if they end up doing that, they do send a message to thousands. You know, Kate and I have both been told that we've helped thousands of people stay in the church, thousands. And so if the church ends up punishing us, what they do is they send a message to these thousands of people that maybe they're not wanted in the church, because I don't know what I've done other than try and ask questions and speak openly about both the good and bad that I see in the church. But even more importantly, I think it's important that whether or not this came as a coordinated effort from the top could absolutely stop it. And we need to remember that they could stop it at any time they wanted to. And so they know now, and so I hope that they will stop this. That's my hope. But yeah, too many people are suffering. This is going to hurt everyone. It's not going to help me to be punished. It's not going to help Kate, but it's also not going to help the members. It's not going to help the church's image. This is a lose-lose for everybody, and that's why I'm calling on this just to stop. I hope they stop it. That's what I hope.
You got a letter from your bishop not so long ago who I think the word de-escalate. Let's back off a little bit. Let's cool this down a little bit. Do you want to say something about that?
No, it was actually for my stake president
right,
the man I still haven't yet met. And yeah, he did use the word de-escalate. And we hope to meet on June 29th. And he's really upset that this went to the media. And I just say, I talked to some very close friends about how to approach this. And the advice I got universally was, if you don't go to the media, you will be excommunicated. And my goal was to stop this because I felt like everyone would be hurt. And it's just the letter, the way the letter was crafted, it just said, you know, resign or we'll hold a court. It felt like the decision had already been made, and that's why. But yeah, he's upset that I went to the media, but he did say he wants to talk. And I'm hopeful that that's a sign that this can be stopped. I'll just say, though, I will feel awful if in some way the dialogue with my stake president leads to me being exonerated, but if Kate still ends up getting punished, because I support, ordained women, and I would feel awful if, especially in a world where gender is such an important issue, I would feel awful if the man kind of got off, but the woman was still punished. That would make me feel terrible. So I'm really mixed about all this, and I hope it ends well for both me and Kate, not just myself.
Let's go to the phones. Patrick's in West Jordan. Welcome.
Hello, Doug. How are you this morning?
Fine, thanks.
I appreciate you having me on. I'm a little befuddled by this, being a lifetime Mormon. Why would you be a member of a church if you don't believe the underlying tenets of it, the foundational parts of the church? Why would you even be in it? Why would you cause yourself that heartache? And the idea that somehow, well, I just have doubts. Well, you can't have doubts of the fundamental foundation issues and be part of it.
Wait. Patrick,
not possible.
Patrick, let me ask you this. You're saying you can't have doubts about those things and be a Mormon?
Well, no. How can you?
What do you mean?
How can you sign on to something, be baptized into a religion, when you don't believe, for instance, Joseph Smith and the Golden Plates? If that's not real to you, if you don't believe that, why are you being baptized into the church? Because it's nonsensical. Why would you even do that to yourself?
So all people who have doubts about those stories don't belong in the Mormon church, from your perspective?
If you have serious enough doubts that you think it's ridiculous, why would you do it? Why would you be baptized? In other words, why would you proclaim your belief in something that in reality you don't? That's just the height of hypocrisy.
But isn't it all based on faith? You know, you're not a sense of knowing something, but believing something, wanting to believe something, the process of working towards some sense of knowledge, some sense of testimony, I think, as you put it. Isn't that also part of the process?
Well, absolutely. But testimony comes from the Holy Ghost. And if you honestly are saying in your interview for baptism that I want to do this, because they're asking you if you have a testimony of that. They're asking you in that interview, do you believe this? And if in your heart of hearts you're saying, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, golden plates, guy being, you know, an angel bringing these down, come on, really? And yet you honestly go ahead with that? I mean, that's just the height of hypocrisy, Doug. Why would you do that?
John,
and honestly, in my view, you know, if you come out against the church about and those foundation issues and you put that in the media, it's right in the handbook of instructions that if you do that openly and you're mocking the church and you're obviously not believing in what you signed on to, that's there. That's apostasy, is it not?
John DeLynn?
Well, several things there. I was baptized when I was 8, long before I learned that the Book of Abraham was not a translation of the Egyptian papyri, long before I learned that Joseph Smith didn't even use the plates when he translated the Book of Mormon, but instead he put his head in a hat with a peepstone. You know, so this notion about hypocrisy and the baptismal interview doesn't really apply to me specifically. On MormonStories.org, I have a Sunstone presentation I gave called Why I Stay. But Mormonism does not wash off. It's not something that you can just throw off like a dirty shirt at the end of the day. I love the church. I love its people. I love the culture. I've had many spiritual experiences within it. It's part of my identity. These things don't just go away. And I'm informed enough to know other faith traditions where they're big enough. They have big enough tents for doubt and questions, and even, you know, disagreement. And so I stay in the church partly as an act of faith or hope that the church can grow and mature to want people like me. And again, I can say I stay because President Uchtdorf said that, and President Holland told me directly that they want people like me in the church. So I don't think it's hypocritical at all. And I just hope that the church is in this process of growing to be able to accept people like me, because the church is strong. The church has a lot of devout members. And I think the church will be stronger if it shows the signal that it's strong enough to have people like us. And so I'm here as a matter of good faith. And I don't think we should be run out, you know?
Yeah. Quick final question. What happens if you're excommunicated? What will it mean right now? You kind of have standing to have this Mormon podcast, to talk about your own doubts, your own concerns, but you're saying them now as a Mormon. What happens if you're excommunicated and you're on the outside? How will that change?
Well, I see Mormon as more as much a cultural identity as it is a religious affiliation. So I still will very much consider myself to be Mormon, even
but,
if I'm
But it matters to you if you're excommunicated, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't. I value my church membership, but I don't want to lose it. I'm sure that it will affect, to some degree, my listenership. It'll affect how people treat me and my family. So, you know, the stakes are high. I think it'll reflect poorly on the church in some ways. So bad things will happen, I think, if I'm excommunicated. I think many people will start asking whether or not they want to stay as members. I hope that doesn't happen. But in many ways, I don't believe that the heavens register will register this event if it happens. I don't believe that my soul will be in jeopardy. I don't think that God or Christ are behind this. At least no God or Christ that I could believe in would be behind this. And so I'm going to continue doing exactly what I'm doing. I'll keep doing the podcast. I'll keep working as a mental health professional for Mormons in crisis. And I think someday what's going to happen is that if the church excommunicates Kate and myself, it's going to receive a backlash that's going to continue to grow, not just with us, but with others. And someday it will lead to the church making positive changes. So I think this will all end up positively for myself, for my family, for the church. That's my hope anyway. And I just hope that it doesn't come to that. I hope cooler heads can prevail, wisdom can be injected, and instead we can find a way out where the church shows itself to be more mature, more loving, more compassionate, and more kind, and more strong, frankly, And that's what I hope ends up happening. But I won't really change much. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. And I hope to do it with a happy and a loving heart, not one that's angry or critical. That's my goal. I hope to be positive throughout this process.
John Dolan, creator of Mormon Stories podcast, joined us from Utah Public Radio in Logan. John, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
We'll take another very quick break and be back in a moment with Kate Kelly. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about a story, as I mentioned, that's getting a lot of attention around here, home of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Two prominent people in the progressive Mormon community have been called before their local leaders, threatened with excommunication. We talked with John Dolan earlier on the program. Kate Kelly is the other one. She's joining us now. She's the founder of Ordain Women. It's a grassroots group of Mormons aimed at gender equality in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. She's a human rights attorney and is living in Utah these days until she moves with her husband to Kenya later this summer. And Kate Kelly, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
When you got the letter, the first letter, I've been asking people if they expected it, and I guess I'll ask you that in a moment, but were you scared?
When I got the first letter, I was just confused because I had already moved from the congregation where the letter was coming from.
Now, this was in Virginia.
And this was in Virginia. So I was just confused about what was happening. I didn't know that there was such a thing as a move restriction, that they could put that on your records and impede you from moving to a new congregation, even though you'd physically moved thousands of miles away. So I was just very, very confused and sad.
So the letter from your stake president said that if you will turn away from the current path you have taken, as we discussed during our meeting, I can help you. But you've been placed on this informal probation of your activities. And this is the thing that's also interesting, is he made it clear in that letter that you can no longer represent yourself as a member in good standing.
That's something that my stake president was highly focused on, is that he didn't want me to present myself. A lot of people are asking me, why did I come forward? Why did I come forward? My stake president actually said in an email to me, if I don't come forward, if I don't tell the media that I'm no longer a member in good standing, that he would. And so it wasn't really my choice to come forward. It was only my choice to present the story from my own perspective.
But I don't get that. Why does he care? That because it gave more credibility to what you were saying, that you were a Mormon, that you had a testimony, that you had all of these beliefs, except for that one thing, or maybe other things, but that, certainly that principally.
Yeah, and I think the thing that maybe to him or to other people that's so threatening is that this is coming from a very faithful, devout perspective. This is not a person, I think this is maybe where John and I are very different. Although I love John and I support him, I have never made any claim against the truth claims of the church. I have never said that I don't believe in the Book of Mormon. I've never made any of these because those aren't my questions and doubts. People should be able to legitimately express doubts like those, but those aren't my doubts. And so I think the most threatening thing about ordained women to people in the power structure of the church is that it's coming from faithful, active, very devout, wonderful, courageous women. And that is more threatening than anything else could be.
Because there's a perception, I guess, that when people are saying outrageous things like women should have the priesthood, that they're saying this from ex-Mormon blogs or outside of the church. But when you're within, it means something entirely different, I suppose.
I think it's – I compare it to a family. You know, when someone on an outside of a family is saying something about a family member, it's very – you know, you're angry and you can easily reject it and dismiss it and you say, how dare you? But if I'm saying something about one of my family members, you know, I'm saying it with love. I'm saying it with nuance. It's me investing in a long-term relationship that I'm committed to, and it adds an ounce of legitimacy.
I guess, so what's being expected of you? You're asked in the letter to refrain from the teachings and actions that undermine the doctrine of the priesthood, the church itself and its leaders, and that you were supposed to take down ordainedwomen.org and then disassociate yourself from ordained women.
in the meeting, the one meeting that I had with my stake president before I left and before I moved, it was the week that I was actually packing up everything and putting it in my car and leaving.
So not a good week.
Not a good week. But when I did meet with him, I looked him in the eye and I said, I want to speak with absolute candor. I am not going to do what you're telling me to do. I am not going to take down the website. I am not going to step down from the board of Ordained Women. I am not going to disassociate myself with the group. And this is why. Because what you're asking me to do is to live inauthentically. What you're asking me to do is show up at church, close my mouth, and never say what I truly think. And that is not something that I can do. I wasn't taught to be that in Young Women's. I was taught to live with integrity. I was taught to do good works. And as a Mormon woman, I was taught to speak the truth. And that's the only thing that I can do.
Do you believe that your religious leaders have an extra measure of insight into the mind of God?
I believe, and I sustain the leaders of the church. We've always said that we sustain Thomas S. Monson as a prophet of God, and that's why we're going through the church leadership structure. That's why the ask of ordained women has been to prayerfully consider the ordination of women, because we acknowledge that that's how revelation occurs, that the prophet leads the church. And so I think that, you know, I think that our leaders are men, they are human, but they are given particular stewardship, and I support and sustain them.
But they've gotten this one wrong.
My local leaders?
No.
Oh.
No, the broad leaders, what you're saying is you sustain and support them, but in regards to the way they believe the place of women, certainly related to whether a woman should be ordained in the Mormon priesthood, they're getting that wrong. They're not getting the right message from God.
What I believe is the ninth article of faith, which said, God will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God. That doesn't say God will reveal small cosmetic changes like putting up a photo of women in the conference center. That means that there are great, important, amazing, fundamental changes that God will yet reveal. And I think that's the most beautiful thing about Mormonism, that the canon is open, that the heavens are not closed. And I think for me, it's just a fundamental disagreement about how revelation occurs. For me, it's Emma Smith asking Joseph Smith about tobacco, and then we get the word of wisdom. It's all of these questions that people ask the leaders to take to the Lord. And I see this as just the part of the pattern of revelation that has been revealed in the scriptures and that we saw in the early church.
It seems like in some way there's this idea that, Kate, why can't you take no for an answer? Okay, you asked us. And I'm not sure if they went to God on this matter or whatever, however it works. But they seem to be saying, okay, we get it. And now, no, sorry, you got to take no for an answer.
I think the questions that we're asking, it's important to remember in the scriptures that we're told to weary the Lord with our petitions. It's important to remember in the scriptures that we are supposed to be ceaseless in our prayers. And that is what we see ordained women doing. We are continuing to ask and continuing to push because we have sincere faith. We believe 100%. I personally believe that despite this setback and despite my personal pain, that women will be ordained. And I compare it to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the Bible. They go into the fiery furnace and they say that they have complete faith that they will be saved. And then they say, but if not, if not, they will continue to serve the Lord. I have 100% faith that someday women will be ordained. I don't know when that will be. It's not my decision to make, but I'm going to keep asking this question.
There's a big question out there, Kate Kelly, about where this came from, whether this was a centralized issue of concern, whether general authorities, members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles or members of the governing First Presidency of the Church sat in some meeting at some point or several meetings at some point and invoked the name of Kate Kelly and or John DeLynn and or whomever else and said, we need to do something about this. This doesn't look good on, you know, television news programs during general conference, that Kate's standing there wherever she might be able to stand and trying to get into the priesthood session. So do you think that they – I mean, the church is saying technically it came from local leaders, but, you know, a lot of people are having a hard time believing that.
I mean, the process is so opaque that it's impossible for me to know exactly where it came from. It's impossible for me to inquire where the directive is coming from, and I'll probably never know. I hold no ill will towards my leaders. I don't think, you know, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles is conspiring against me. We've issued—
But are they talking about you? Are they talking about you?
I feel like there's a difference between talking about us and talking to us. We've requested 5 different meetings with all church leaders, including the female auxiliaries, and never received a response. I feel like if I could just sit down with one of the leaders and they could just see who I really am, and if they could engage in this conversation, not about me, but with me and with us as sincere, faithful Mormon women, the outcome could be very different.
I wonder, this idea of just kind of, it seems like there's this message of, Kate, it's okay for you to feel this way, but just keep your mouth shut. Don't say it on a website. You can feel that. So why is that so important that you say this out loud?
I wrote an op-ed in The Guardian today, and what I talked about specifically is in my letter, it says that I am no longer allowed to respond. If I'm asked a question in church, I'm no longer allowed to read a passage out loud. I'm no longer to raise my hand and make a comment. That is explicitly stated in my punishment letter. And I think that's emblematic of the problem this type of disciplinary counsel is intended to do, which is to silence me. And to, you know, my stake president said, you don't have to change your mind, you just can't say anything about it. And I think that's the most insidious, terrible part of this entire process, is to tell someone, you can think whatever you want, but you can't open your mouth. When I was a missionary, there was a slogan, and it was open your mouth. That was what we were taught to do. We were taught to open our mouths, to speak, to engage with people, to teach people, to learn about gospel topics. And everything I've learned as a Mormon woman teaches me that that is wrong. To silence someone, to push someone down, to make them close their mouths is not what Christ taught.
I wanted to ask you about something. I understand your parents who live in Provo. Reportedly, their bishop took away your parents' temple recommends because they refused to disassociate with the ordained women movement. Now, that strikes some as kind of cruel.
I think it's so terribly sad. And for me, one of the most painful parts of this process, that people I know and love and associate with are being punished for also speaking out. But I also think it speaks volumes about my parents. They taught me that it's okay to stand up to authority. They taught me as a young girl that it's okay to speak your mind. And they taught me to be who I am. So the fact that they are standing by me, I think, speaks volumes about them and about the way that I was raised.
What do you think the effect is going to be, the public relations effect on Mormonism? I mean, Orthodox Mormons may be applauding this clamping down that's going on right now, but what kind of effect do you think it has on the public image of Mormonism or those who might be on the fringes within Mormonism?
I think this has a very... you know, potentially has a very negative effect on Mormonism. I think it's important to keep in mind that the decision hasn't been made. Ostensibly, the council will consider the evidence that I provide and my letter, and it's not too late for them to do the right thing. And so the outcome is not yet determined. And I have faith that they will hear my pleas and they will understand me for who I am, which is a faithful, devout, considerate, and Mormon woman. However, if the church decides to excommunicate me at this point, I think a lot of people are going to struggle. A lot of people are going to see this very negatively. And so that's my fear, that it's not too late to do the right thing. But if they don't, it will reflect very poorly on the institution.
We're going to have a chance to ask a representative of the LDS Church tomorrow. They've agreed to join us for the whole hour, which is remarkable and terrific, and we're grateful for that. But you've talked about how you think there may be a firewall between leaders and laity. And this is the PR department of the church, that in some way maybe this is being driven not by the First Presidency, not by the Quorum of the Twelve necessarily, but those who are managing the public image of the church.
I think in every institution, especially large institutions, there's a layer between the people in the general membership and the leaders at the top. And in our case, that happens to be the Public Affairs Department of the church, led by Michael Otterson. And so far, they've been the only ones to respond. So I think I'm very justified in saying that they're the ones between us and the church leaders. And their responses have gotten increasingly negative, increasingly aggressive, increasingly, characterizing us in a way that we're not very intentionally. And again, that comes back to the fact that the most threatening part about ordaining women is that we are reverent, that we are respectful, that we are faithful, and that we will continue to be.
Let me ask you this finally. It's the same question I asked of John DeLynn. Right now you're in, and you're making these comments from within. What happens if you're out? What happens if you get excommunicated? How does that change the dynamic? How does that change the way you see yourself?
This week has been a very difficult one for me because I've always felt that Mormonism is the most special thing about me. It's always the first thing I tell people. It's always a topic of discussion. I'm very, very proud of being a Mormon. So it will be very personally devastating for me to be excluded from the body of the church forcibly. For the movement, I don't think it will negatively affect the movement. There's not just Kate Kelly. If it was just Kate Kelly, one person saying that women should be ordained, that wouldn't be a movement. There's hundreds and thousands of people behind us and more. We've gotten 75 profile submissions this week to ordainwomen.org. We've had...
It seems awfully courageous in the scheme of things, doesn't it?
It's extremely courageous. And I think that's the difference between past purges and what's currently happening, that people are not backing down, that people want to live authentically. People want to be able to ask questions and engage simultaneously with the church. We love the church. For me, this is an investment in the church that I love. And like John said, so many thousands of people have contacted us and saying, this gives me hope. This keeps me in the church. And I see ordained women as a retention effort.
It's Kate Kelly, the founder of Ordained Women, a grassroots group of Mormons aimed at gender equality in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, moving to Kenya later this summer. When?
We're waiting on the visas, so hopefully in July.
Good luck. Mm-hmm. Kate, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. You can continue the conversation, of course, by going to our website. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.